Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
There is great pleasure to be found in beautiful things. When one person loves a particular painting or another is drawn in by a sculpture or building or sunset, the pleasure sensors in our brain respond unmistakably to things we find lovely to look at, even when they don't have any practical value at all in the moment. But why? How did we become so deeply wired for beauty that we go to the trouble of making art? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Anjan Chatterjee is Elliott Professor and Chief of Neurology at Pennsylvania Hospital, and these are questions that have intrigued him for a long time. His new book focuses on the way our brains reward us when we encounter something exquisite and how that relates to our survival as a species. The book is called The Aesthetic Brain: How We Evolved to Desire Beauty and Enjoy Art. Anjan, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Okay, let's start with this. What is neuroaesthetics and what makes it a valuable field of study?
Neuroaesthetics is, as the title suggests, the way in which we think about aesthetics as implemented in the brain. So, as you mentioned in your introduction, people are preoccupied by beauty. People invest a lot of time and effort to acquire art, and it's not obvious why we do that. And so the question is, what's happening in our brain that guides these experiences and these kinds of behaviors that on the surface seem to not make a lot of sense?
In this book, you're dealing mostly with how we respond to what we see. Are brain responses to things like music and theater and literature just somehow too different to fit into this book?
There are similarities and differences with respect to music or literature. I think some of the emotional responses are that there is certainly some overlap to those aesthetic experiences. But the quality of the sensations are different. So the kinds of sensations when we're looking at objects that tickle our reward centers are different than those that have to do with music. And to tackle music and literature would be an equally large task. And so for the purposes of this book, and in part because I know more about the visual system than the auditory system, and I know more about visual art than about music, I decided to confine the discussions to visual aesthetics, although, again, some of the principles would certainly generalize to those other domains of aesthetics.
And when you say visual aesthetics, it's important to note that it's not exactly the same thing. Not all art is visually pleasing. Not all art makes us happy and brings us joy, and not all art is beautiful.
Right. And this has been especially true in the latter half of the 20th century, where a lot of modern art or conceptual art has nothing to do with beauty. So, you know, if you went into a museum of contemporary art, often it's for the layperson, it's even hard to understand why these objects that are displayed are even art. And there isn't an obvious way in which people respond either with pleasure to these objects or think that they are necessarily beautiful. A piece of that has always been true in art going back a long way, but is especially true now. So you're absolutely right that that while beauty is a big part of aesthetic experiences are not confined to beauty.
What is happening in our brain when we see something we find beautiful?
So we think about this in the context of three broad kinds of circuits. One has to do with our sensory and motor systems, so the kinds of systems in our brain that take in information and then somehow use that information to produce an output. So that's one broad system. The second system has to do with our emotions and our reward systems, if we're talking about pleasure. But usually in response to an aesthetic object, we have some kind of emotional response, and so those systems are engaged. And then there's a third broad system, which has to do with knowledge and meaning, and the way we interpret the world, our own personal experiences, our memories. All of that has a modulating effect on our sensory experiences and our emotional reactions to those. So in the brain, you have these three very large systems that coordinate in the context of an aesthetic experience to give rise to how we react to beautiful objects or how we react to artworks.
That's all very complex. So it probably is that what explains the fact that you and I could look at the same painting by a master artist and have a different response. You might be not that impressed and I might love it or vice versa.
Yes, and that's where especially the meaning and knowledge piece comes into play. And there's a very clear historic example of this, which is the Impressionist artists at the end of the 19th century, when they first started to produce their work, were pretty much decried universally, that the salons of Paris didn't understand it, didn't think it was particularly attractive. People in general didn't like that kind of artwork. And if you fast forward 100, 125 years later, and you do surveys now of the general population, particularly in America, it turns out that Impressionist paintings are liked the most by most people. And so that's an example where in 100 or 125 years, our brains really haven't changed, but the reaction to exactly the same thing that people are looking at can be quite different. And at a smaller scale is what you're talking about, where you might, for example, you might like Picasso and I might like Matisse, and you know they're quite different. But we have our personal preferences that has to do with our own experiences and our knowledge that we bring to bear when we're looking at these things.
On the other hand, Anjan, you know, it's rare to meet somebody who says, "I just can't stand sunsets." You know, like there are certain things that seem to be universally appealing.
Yes, and so I think if we take it outside the realm of art, there are certain things that seem to be very common. And certain kinds of landscapes, as you suggest, are commonly liked. And the other classic example are people. So when we think about faces or people's bodies, there generally is quite large agreement on the kinds of faces that people find beautiful. So for example, there have been surveys done of who the most beautiful face was in the 20th century, and a lot of people will pick, someone like Audrey Hepburn. And in typically the top 10 people, there tends to be a fair amount of agreement on who is regarded as beautiful. So in naturalistic objects like people, faces, and places, there does tend to be a fair amount of agreement.
You have written about the fact that humans seem to really like savanna landscapes, and there may be something, there would be a sort of evolutionary sense to the fact that we find those landscapes appealing.
Yes. There's a concrete interpretation of that, which is that if we all came out of Africa and evolved in the savannas, that maybe there is something about those landscapes that taps into a kind of yearning for home or sort of going back to our roots. The alternate explanation for that is that there are certain characteristics that appear in savannas that if they appear in any kind of landscape that people generally tend to like them, and especially when they're younger. So under the age of 10, children will often prefer those kinds of landscapes even if they've never been there. And ultimately, the idea is that in those landscapes, there are two features that are important, which is that there is a sense of safety so that one doesn't feel as though they are in danger. And the other is that there is evidence of sources of nourishment. So safety and nourishment seem to be important for landscapes that people generally find beautiful.
What role does our need for food play into what we find beautiful?
I'm sorry, ask the question again. Our what for food?
Our need for food, the desire to find food and find nutrition.
I think the kinds of evolutionary arguments that we make, or not we as in me, but people in evolutionary psychology make, is that certain preferences, that people that have certain kinds of preferences, when they play out, when their behavior plays out in response to those preferences, that they are more likely to survive and more likely to propagate into future generations. And so on those grounds, if, again, we're talking about many, many years ago, often people talk about this broad swath of time referred to as the Pleistocene, that the desire for food, and in particular in that period, things like fat and sugar and protein, which are really critical, the desire for that kind of food or the preference for landscapes that provided that would mean that those people would end up settling in those places and end up being relatively healthy and continuing to propagate down the line, and along with that, the preference for those kinds of landscapes.
Of course, we can find things beautiful when we're not hungry. You know, we could look at a still life and still think it's spectacular, even if it doesn't contain food necessarily that we would eat. There must be more to it than that.
Yeah, I think there is more to it. And this gets back to, if we take it back to art, why is it that we find artworks, at least some artworks, beautiful when, as you say, we don't necessarily plan to consume them? And so here it's worth talking a little bit about the reward systems in our brain, which is that when we think about pleasure, things that give us pleasure, sort of that good feeling, it can probably be divided into two subcomponents. And there's some fairly good neuroscience on this. And colloquially, these two systems are referred to as liking and wanting. And the idea in general is that we typically like what we want and we want what we like, but these systems can get dissociated. In the brain, they operate kind of deep in the brain in the front, just above our eyes in an area called orbital frontal cortex, and even deeper, just to use some of the jargon, an area called the ventral striatum. And these systems tend to work together, but they do have different chemical bases. So desire or wanting seems to be driven by the chemical called dopamine, which many people have probably heard about, and liking, or this hedonic response, is largely driven by cannabinoid and opiate receptors. And in part, that may have something to do with why those are drugs of abuse, of recreation, because when we ingest either opiates or cannabinoids exogenously, we are flooding those same receptors that exist in the brain. So going back to your question, what I argue in the book is that the quintessential aesthetic experience is really about the liking without necessarily the wanting. So I can look at a painting and really enjoy it and like it without necessarily having that pleasure accompanied by an acquisitive impulse, which would be, I would like to own it. I think it might be a good investment. If I put it up in my living room, I would impress my friends. While all of those things can be useful, we think those are not the quintessential aesthetic experiences.
My guest is Anjan Chatterjee, Elliott Professor and Chief of Neurology at Pennsylvania Hospital. His new book is called The Aesthetic Brain, How We Evolved to Desire Beauty and Enjoy Art. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 800-933-5372. If you go on Twitter to me, at Chris Boyd Think, you can see a photograph taken by our guest this hour.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Anjan Chatterjee, who is Elliott Professor and Chief of Neurology at Pennsylvania Hospital and author of the new book, The Aesthetic Brain, How We Evolve to Desire Beauty and Enjoy Art. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Anjan, what makes human brains so good at spotting patterns? Why do we need this ability?
It's a good question. I think we need this ability because we are constantly surrounded by so much stimulation, and that's true now as much as it ever has been. And to get around and to sort of navigate the world and navigate all of the information that's coming in, we need to have systems by which we can chunk the world and sort of put it into more discrete and manageable portions. And some of that is pattern recognition, so that you see a pattern, you don't have to identify each of the individual elements in the pattern. You see the entire pattern, and that ends up being a very useful ability to have that all people have. There are some conditions with brain damage in which that can be disrupted, and it's very it can impair people's ability to function in the world. But nonetheless, the idea of being very skilled at recognizing patterns makes us move through the world much more efficiently.
So what does our ability to spot patterns have to do with our ability to enjoy the sight of them?
So if we go from the other direction, it looks like certain patterns are found to be more beautiful. And a classic one in faces would be symmetry. People that have symmetric faces, or you can do this on computers and make faces more symmetric, are generally regarded as more attractive over faces that are not exactly symmetric or less symmetric. I should say that if something is perfectly symmetric, it gets a little odd, and people don't like that. It seems a bit artificial. But short of that, the more symmetric faces are, the more people like it. And there is a hypothesis in aesthetics that's referred to as the fluency hypothesis. And what that states basically is that if we can process objects more easily, that we tend to like them. And this goes back to this sort of pattern recognition, of which symmetry is the most obvious and the simple one. There is, again, this idea that people who had a preference for patterns and a preference for this kind of distilling of a lot of information into more comprehensible chunks were more likely to navigate their world successfully.
Okay, so I'm gonna challenge you here a little bit.
Okay.
One might see a really symmetrical lizard face or bat face and find it less beautiful than, let's just set aside human faces, less beautiful than, say, a tiger's face that is very symmetrical. So there's got to be something else going on besides just symmetry.
Yeah, so beauty, I kind of use this in the book. I talk about beauty as a mongrel. And as a mongrel, I don't mean that to be pejorative in any way, that it is what we end up thinking of as beautiful is an amalgam of many different properties, of which this kind of pattern and symmetry is one, but not the only one. And so to take your example and to approach that the way an experimentalist might, you might say, well, within the category of tigers or the category of bats and lizards, which bats and which lizards look more attractive than others, right? And then I would predict, although I have not, and I'm not aware of anybody who's done this experiment, that you would see the same thing, which is that lizards that are a little more symmetric than asymmetric ones are regarded as more attractive.
Tell us about the golden ratio. What is that?
The golden ratio is something that had, has been a preoccupation since the time of the Greeks, and it's a specific ratio that forms a rectangle that shows up in all sorts of things. It shows up in parts of the Parthenon. It shows up. There's something analogous called the golden spiral that is inscribed within the golden ratio. And just to be technical, the ratio basically, I think it comes out to be a ratio about 1 to 1.3, although I'd have to go back and make sure that that's correct. But it's a pattern that shows up in all sorts of architectural designs and in various aspects of nature as well. And some people have thought that there is something about this particular pattern that we find beautiful, that it is telling us something about the way in which nature is organized, and that people who are sensitive to that kind of organization are also the inference is that they're also sensitive to those kinds of patterns in nature. I should point out that it is, while there has been a lot written about the golden ratio, when people have actually tried to look at this in the lab, it doesn't always work out to be exactly what the golden ratio is for the kinds of proportions people like if they're just given a whole series of proportions.
I'm interested in how culture shapes what we believe to be beautiful. I think we've all walked into museums and seen like ancient works of sculpture that are like believed to be fertility symbols. Some of them might strike modern eyes as sort of grotesquely exaggerated. On the other hand, ancient people might not have been impressed with today's supermodels.
Yeah. So that's a great question. And people, are always asking and rightly curious about the question of whether and to what extent is beauty universal and to what extent is it culturally determined. And we think it is to a large extent culturally determined. And as I mentioned at the top of the hour, that the way in which our experiences and our backgrounds play into this has a huge impact. And let me give a few examples to illustrate how these universal and cultural features play into things. So if we take faces again, and I'll come back to art. If we take faces, we know that there are certain parameters that consistently contribute to faces that people think are attractive. And one of those, we talked about symmetry. Another one is something that is referred to as averaging. And what that means is if you take a bunch of faces and you combine them, and this can be done digitally, so you have 16 faces and you come up with a face that is the best average of all of those faces. Almost always, people think the averaged face is more attractive than the individual faces that contributed to that average face. Okay, so that's just an empirical observation. So how might that play out? The way it plays out is that in our everyday lives, we are constantly forming these kinds of prototypes and averages of the faces we encounter. So if I live in a community that has a restricted range of ethnicities, my experience will be entirely determined and the prototypes of faces that I have in my mind will be determined by that, which might be very different than someone who grows up in a multi-ethnic, multi-racial environment where their prototypes might be quite different. So that's an example where there is a universal process going on, which is this averaging, but the outcome of that universal process might be highly determined by the environment in which someone lives. So that's when it comes to faces. You use the example of artwork. The example that for me personally makes sense is if you look at Australian Aboriginal art, it is quite abstract. It's pointillistic. I find it very beautiful. And at the same time, I don't have any of the cultural background of what these artworks mean. They have a very specific meaning within Aboriginal culture that has to do with their relationship to the land. And yet I can find it beautiful. But there's no doubt that if I I was better informed about how that artwork is placed within their culture, my experience of that would be very different.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with Rhonda in Richardson. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi. Yes, I have a question that really ties into yesterday's conversation in the second hour. The young lady mentioned about the dreamers that returned back to Mexico, and I may be getting it totally out of context, but this is what I was left with. She mentioned that the students, when they go back, that there's like a preference for the lighter skin, the lighter eye. They're perceived to be more beautiful, perceived to be more successful. And just yesterday, my daughter and I were talking about her trip to Curaçao, and she mentioned, you know, that the native people there are generally darker skinned, but there's this perception that lighter skin, straighter hair, lighter eyes is more beautiful. So my question is, why is it in most cultures, no matter what the native culture is that lighter, brighter, curlier or straighter hair is always perceived to be more beautiful, whereas in the animal kingdom, when there's a flock of birds, for instance, if one of them is different, they're sometimes even pecked to death because they are different.
Thanks so much for your call, Rhonda.
So I would start by saying it's an empirical question whether that is true in all cultures, that lighter skin, you know, fair eyes and so on are regarded as more attractive. I think where that needs to be separated out is the fact that in many of the parts of the world, whether it's Asia or Africa or Central and South America, there is a robust history of colonialism that probably plays into this, which is that the dominant groups start to be regarded as beautiful, and there's a conflation of dominance with beauty, which turns out happens quite frequently. So, but the question could be asked in some ways, which gets harder and harder now, but has sometimes been asked of, is there something common to what kinds of faces people find beautiful if they have not had contact with people from, say, the Western developed world? And in those instances, while I'm not aware that the specific question of fairness of skin has been asked, it is clear, and this goes back to the averaging idea that I mentioned before, it is clear that people are responsive to averaging within the culture to which they are exposed. And so that's the kind of question where one might imagine, and again, in my mind, this is an empirical question that has not really been addressed, one might imagine that if the background population of people were regarded as, you know, were of darker skin, that someone who was fair might not be regarded as attractive.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Chad is on the line now in Dallas. Hey, Chad.
Howdy. I had, going back to the averaging question again, would the genetic, would that indicate a genetic diversity, which would be evolutionary advantageous, is possibly why we might find that attractive?
Yes, that's exactly right. And that's how people tend to think about this, which is that a lot of our physiognomy, the way we look, is in part determined by our genes. And you can think of this as sort of classic kind of tribal looks, right? So you might say, you might look at someone and say, oh, he or she looks Irish, or oh, he or she looks like she's from Nigeria. You know, we have these kinds of ideas of the way certain people look from certain kinds of ethnicities. And what you're saying is exactly right, which is the greater the genetic diversity we have, the more likely we are to withstand the things in the environment, and the more likely our progeny are likely to survive. And this averaging idea is largely thought to be an indicator of underlying genetic diversity. And in a lot of, say, contemporary cultures, contemporary urban cultures, there is this general intuition that people have that I think also plays in this, which is that mixed-race children are often more attractive than are often regarded as quite attractive, and I think that's really that's playing into the same idea. But your fundamental point is exactly how we think about it.
We know that women, depending on hormone levels throughout the month, can find particular kinds of male faces more or less attractive. Do hormones have anything to do with our experience of art that is, you know, an image of a person or an image of anything else?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and I don't know that I know the answer to that. So just to fill in the listeners to, I think, what you're referring to, is that when people have studied attraction, and this is specifically in the context of young people and heterosexual norms, so we should be clear about that, that women tend to be... women's preferences tend to vary a little bit depending on where in their cycle they are. And this is called the ovulatory hypothesis.
All right, I'm going to jump in here, take a quick break. We can finish this thought in a moment. My guest is Anjan Chatterjee, Elliott Professor and Chief of Neurology at Pennsylvania Hospital and author of the new book, The Aesthetic Brain, How We Evolve to Desire Beauty and Enjoy Art. Join us at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour to the Elliott Professor and Chief of Neurology at Pennsylvania Hospital, Anjan Chatterjee. His new book is called The Aesthetic Brain, How We Evolve to Desire Beauty and Enjoy Art. Join us at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Anjan, you were talking about this ovulatory effect before the break, and did you sort of finish your thought there, or was there anything else you needed to add?
Yes, I just wanted to finish that thought, which is that it turns out women find different kind of features in men attractive depending on where in the cycle they are. And so the effects of testosterone on male features, which tend to be, you know, having a square jaw, a dominant brow, kind of a classic Dick Tracy sort of look, that women tend to find those kinds of faces more attractive at the time of ovulation. And away from the time of ovulation, women tend to find faces like that that are just slightly feminized. And again, these can be done on computers and so forth. And so the argument is often that women prefer certain kinds of partners for short-term affairs versus long-term affairs, and that the effects of testosterone seems to play into that. The question you asked me, would that affect people's choices in paintings, for example, portraits? I have no idea. I don't know whether it would be sufficiently removed from sort of the impulse to find a partner or not, but it's a good question.
So you've told us so many interesting things, Anjan, about how we respond to visual imagery, why we desire it. What have you learned about why humans want to make art?
Yeah, so that's also a great question. And it's something I don't address a lot in the book, but it does seem that we have this impulse to decorate constantly, right? We're always, rearranging things in our environment. People can be quite picky about the clothes they wear to present themselves. It does seem as though there is a universal desire to decorate and beautify our environments. And some people think that this fundamental aspect of being creative and wanting to produce these things itself has an evolutionary advantage, whether it has to do with solving problems and figuring things out and engineering our environment, and that some of that then bleeds over into these decorative elements, which you can go back as far back as people find remnants of proto-humans, whether they're decorations on bones or in caves. It seems as though this has been around for a long time.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Robertus in Dallas. Hi, Robertus.
Hello. How are you today?
Very well, thanks.
I was very interested in this. I've spent years teaching art history, and also I'm a practicing artist. And I've been fascinated with the Stenzel syndrome, the process whereby a person, in a sense, becomes overload, receives overloads of positive aesthetics into the sensory system and becomes almost sort of dysfunctional in some respects. And I'm wondering if Dr. Chatterjee's work looked at that process of how Stenzel syndrome occurs and could perhaps talk a little bit about it.
This, Robertus, is like people who get dizzy spells when they look at the Mona Lisa or some great work of art.
Yeah, or are confronted with perhaps, being in the Sistine Chapel. I've personally had experiences, attending sculpture and objects of functional art, the SOFA shows in Chicago, things of that sort, where I just found that I just really was overloaded, and
yeah.
it was positive, but it made you a little bit dysfunctional also.
What do you know about that, Anjan?
So I am embarrassed to say I don't know the syndrome, despite being a cognitive neurologist. But so with that as the caveat, let me try to answer the question with some coherence. So people... And this goes back a little bit to the pattern recognition we were talking about earlier, which is that we are always confronted with a huge amount of information, and in some instances that can be overwhelming, and this is true for everybody. In some instances, for example, people with attention deficit disorder can get distracted very easily and become somewhat dysfunctional if they're in an environment where a lot is going on. My guess is, and I had two thoughts simultaneously. My guess is under some circumstances, and the Sistine Chapel might be a good one, where especially someone who knows a lot about art history, it's not just the sensory information that's coming in, but all of the knowledge and the history that is evoked by looking at that, that all then tips over, past a point where it is in the moment as pleasurable as it might. And there's a general principle about complexity that some people have talked about, which is that people tend to like images as they get more and more complex, but up to a point that if it passes that level of complexity, that people get overwhelmed. And I suspect that, where that curve tips over as things become more complex varies for person to person. And for a given person, it probably varies depending on the environment in which they are.
Can an understanding of neuroscience make one a better artist? I know that you're a photographer when you have time.
I think it makes you think about these things perhaps differently. I don't know if it makes you a better artist in the moment, but I think when, you know, so artists work really hard, you know, so I think every artist out there that's listening to this recognizes that it's not as though these inspirations just spring from your head without a lot of preparation and a lot of work. And I think the study, you know, so if you're a musician, you're going to learn scales and practice and practice and do various things. I think in the same way, an understanding of both the neuroscience and the psychology of aesthetics allows you to be critical of your own work using a set of tools. And I think that potentially can help you improve what you're doing. But I would say it's one of many critical tools that one can use to look at one's own work and try to figure out how to make it better.
Yeah, I was reading an article just today about how Netflix will try to calculate like the attributes in a TV show or a series that will make people want to keep watching. And I was thinking that surely that's helpful information, but it would be really hard to reverse engineer something that had great artistic merit.
I think that probably is true, yes. The day that we can program something to produce good art, I don't think is going to happen anytime soon.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Juan on the line in Carrollton. Hi, Juan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
See, one of the things that's always interested me about aesthetics, and people talk about it in, like, usually one purview and not another, and it's not a very multidisciplinary way. And I got fascinated by the idea of the role, ethnicity, race, all these kind of social constructs exacted themselves out in aesthetics, particularly because when Western aesthetics saw non-Western aesthetics, they always used that matrix or that calculus, even, say, in the Spanish defense or like Bartolomeo de las Casas defending the Mesoamericans, they always use aesthetic arguments in terms of like our artwork was good, so therefore we were good, or we had the capability or capacity to be good, and it played such an instrumental role in their decision to start viewing indigenous people in the Americas as potentially Christians or even human beings and not slaves. So these kind of aesthetic judgments, right, that are made so much and have played such an integral role in how people perceive beauty and in the Western world, to how that equates to good, I think has real ramifications in contemporary society, because so much of what I think people of color need is kind of to know where these perceptions of beauty and good come from, because we live in a predominantly Westernized world.
What do you have thoughts on that, Anjan?
Sure. I think your caller raises a very good and very important point. So the Greeks thought there were three fundamental values which had to do with beauty, good, and truth. And it turns out that those things are constantly conflated with each other,
right,
which is that people that are beautiful are thought to be also good. And there's a lot of social psychology around this, which is, for example, beautiful children are given better grades for the exact same essays. People that are beautiful typically get higher pays. If they're criminals, they get lesser offenses. And so these kinds of cognitive biases are built into our system. And as the caller says, it's absolutely critical that people be aware of these biases. So you can try to avoid them or compensate for them. And I think that also plays out in these kinds of histories of either colonialism or dominance that also play out. In a very, you know, we've been running some experiments in my lab looking at almost the reverse of this, which is looking at people pictures of people with minor facial deformities that can be corrected surgically. And it turns out that people ascribe all kinds of social attributes to minor facial deformities, like the person is not as smart, or they're not good, or they're not competent, that make no sense at all. And so I think it is important to understand that these are built into our system, but just because they're built into the system doesn't mean that we have to be enslaved to those kinds of biases.
Do you think our tendency to create art is tied in an evolutionary fashion to the fact that we are innovators, we are problem solvers, we take disparate ideas and put them together and create something new?
Yes, I think the idea of innovating and problem solving contributes to the making of art. Often when people are making art, they're trying to solve a problem. Some people have also thought that it's a way of demonstrating our own prowess. And then when it comes to literary arts, which we haven't talked about and I don't really address in the book, the other idea is that stories are a way for us to expand our experiences without having to live through them. And so the creation of stories, you know, if you're a fantastic creator of stories, it's a way for you to communicate information to me where I get to learn what it might be to experience that without having to go through it. And it's a device to expand our knowledge in an efficient and very quick way.
How has your study of neuroaesthetics changed your relationship to things that you find beautiful?
Well, I always had in some ways the question goes in the other direction, is that I always had a preoccupation with things that were decorative or things that are beautiful. You know, if I buy a toaster, it's not just buying a toaster, it's buying a toaster that looks well, you know, looks well at my kitchen.
Right.
So I think it was more the preoccupation with that made me eventually want to start to ask the question of, you know, what's going on? Why do I have this kind of preoccupation?
Why do I need a beautiful toaster?
Why do I need a beautiful toaster? I mean, a toaster is a toaster is a toaster, but it's not really.
Anjan Chatterjee is Elliott Professor and Chief of Neurology at Pennsylvania Hospital. His new book is called The Aesthetic Brain, How We Evolve to Desire Beauty and Enjoy Art. Anjan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for spending this hour with us.
Very much enjoyed it. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Braylon Becton. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.